Welcome to a special episode of the Left Behind podcast. I'm your host, Chris Markovich. On this special episode, we talk about men's mental health, the struggle to speak up and speak out, and the pressures to man up, even in the face of a pandemic. So it's been a while since I've done any content for the LB podcast, and I wanted to give all of you folks an update on the situation as of late. I know that COVID-19 has been rough on all of us, but my mental health hasn't been the greatest since the pandemic began, and so I wanted to address some of those things today on this show. Over the course of my life, I've struggled a lot with being able to focus on tasks and, you know, in general, just being able to pay attention. And I never really gave it much thought beyond the usual, oh, I'm just distracted, or I'm just disorganized. And I just kind of left it at that. But in recent months, I've really been forced to focus on my behavior and my mental health because this pandemic has really brought about a sense of urgency that wasn't really there before. And mortality is a funny thing. It makes us think about things we wouldn't normally think about. It makes us behave in ways that we wouldn't normally behave in. And for me, it's been a hard thing to think about and a hard thing to realize. And when I stopped making content for this show back in late March, early April, I didn't give it much thought at first. I thought I would just take a little bit of a break, because I was focused on taking care of myself and my partner while she was staying with me throughout the early stages of the pandemic. But later on, I began to notice that the fact I wasn't producing any content was really starting to weigh heavily on me. And the more it weighed heavily on me, the more I pushed it aside. And it just became this sort of vicious cycle that culminated a few weeks ago in the realization that there's something wrong. There's something going on, and I'm not sure what it is. My partner suggested to me that it was probably due to the fact that I still have, as of yet, undiagnosed ADHD. And at first, I wasn't sure if I knew that she was right or that I just wanted to believe her because she has a professional background in being a behavioral therapist. But then she gave me this book that I started reading over the last couple of weeks. It's from Gabor Mate, who specializes in attention deficit disorder and works with a lot of adults and children who have it. And I began reading this book. I'm about 9 chapters in now. And just about every story he related, I was saying to myself, that's me. That's me. And all of the behavioral issues and all of the environmental factors that were contributing to this kind of lack of focus, highly distractible behaviors became really, really apparent to me. And so I've begun this journey on really discovering what it is that I need to deal with. And that's why I started doing this show again. I really need to make sure that the projects that I care about, that I really believe in, I stay focused on. And this particular episode is no exception. I spoke with 3 men who are going through similar struggles, who have been dealing with the effects of their mental health and their anxiety, and who have their own personal stories to relate, and possibly, if you're listening, some advice. I invite you now to join us on that journey. Joining me now on the show is Ryan Painter, the man behind men2health.co. He's a mental health advocate and advocate, a public speaker, and is also a local, provincial, and federal advocate for mental health policies, and he coaches men living with mental health challenges and anxiety. Ryan, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Great to be here, Chris. Thanks so much for inviting me. It's actually kind of nice to be inside, given that we're in a heat wave here in Victoria. So it's a good time to be on the radio.
Yes, exactly. It's just the same up here. We're going to be going up to, I think, 29 degrees again today. So I wanted to ask you about your journey through advocacy for mental health, as well as your own personal experience. What started you on this journey, and why did you start Mental Health?
Wow. That kind of conversation could literally take hours. I guess
just you could the cliff notes then.
Yeah, the cliff notes. I mean, I really started this journey, I think in not an intentional way when I nearly died by suicide when I was 22. That incident started me on a path to discovering my own mental health challenges, but also learning the reasons why, up until I was 22 years old, I had never actually engaged with those things that were impacting my mental health my mental health and actually causing mental health challenges for myself. So it was basically, I call it a 10, 11, 12 year journey of learning about the things in my life, whether it was trauma, whether it was interfamily conflict, whether it was, various challenges with growing up with cleft lip and palate and surgeries. I mean, when I was 3 months old, and then, 6 months old, I had surgeries on my face that had me put under anesthesia. And there have been some studies that have actually found that children, and babies who are quite young that are put under anesthesia or actually have a higher proportion of a chance to develop mental health challenges later in their life. So there seems to be a bit of a causal link there. But it was through this journey of kind of finding out myself and who I was, where I really found a power in talking about my struggles, and how talking about my struggles really enabled me to claim ownership over them. And it was an important piece for my own recovery to actually be able to name what I was dealing with and what I was struggling with, to talk about it, to put it out there, and really use social media as a way to leverage my experience to show other people, especially men, that this is something that a man out there is experiencing, and he's doing okay. I mean, he does struggle from time to time, but he's doing okay. Of course, I use my own experiences to run for school board, which I did here in Greater Victoria School District, securing a seat on the school district board to continue to advocate for mental health in youth. And so it's been this whole kind of mix of life experiences, engagement with other people, working up at the University of Victoria, and all these other things that eventually led me to see, there is more I can do in this space. And so I started talking to other men just online and in my life, and understanding one of the key pieces that they're really missing is motivation and motivational work in their life, and understanding how to kind of break down those obstacles that cause overwhelm in their life. Whether they have mental health challenges or not, the issues around overwhelm and motivation can be really limiting. And it's those things that I really wanted to kind of turn my attention to, and kind of work to support men, whether they have mental health challenges or not. But it really is also about helping men through that journey of self-discovery.
Now, you mentioned your struggles and identifying what those were. Can you talk a little bit about how you came about really giving your anxiety and your struggles a name, identifying it for yourself and saying, yes, that's what's happening for me, and this is what I'm going to do to help myself? When did you come to that realization, and how did that change how you were dealing with the everyday struggle?
It's a really good question, Chris. For me, it was actually an evolution of mental health challenges. So I started in my teenage years with a lot of anger, and that anger was actually hiding quite severe depression, which was what eventually led to my near suicide when I was 22. And it was in realizing that I was depressed and actually owning that, because up until then, I had really kind of given way to this machismo, men don't cry, men don't need help, men don't need support, this attitude that is really ingrained in men and boys at a really young age. And I had been surrounded my whole life by men who I viewed and envisioned as quite tough and quite strong, whether it was my my grandfather, who was an immigrant from Denmark and who had been a boilermaker and a welder and worked on building dams across the country. Like, this guy was someone who I saw as like the pinnacle of like the tough, manly man. My stepdad, who was a bodybuilder, or my dad, who was a welder and in carpentry, like these men who were all in my life and I viewed as so strong. And I had never really seen that in myself. I had never really seen their strength reflected in me at a very young age. I'd always been kind of like the emotional nerd gamer who never really kind of took to the fixing cars and building sheds kind of thing. That just wasn't me. And so that really played, I think, into a lot of self-defeating, self-deprecating thought. But what was there as well was depression that had actually existed in my family and in men in my family for a long time, but nobody had ever talked about it until I started talking about it. And so I was definitely in my early mid-20s when I started really kind of focusing on the depression piece and saying, yeah, you know, this is something I can really see when my mood takes a dip. I can see the triggers that cause me to look inward and be really self-critical and get almost to the point of self-harm. And it was really quite pointed until I was teaching overseas in South Korea and in China. It was my last year from 2012 to 2013. My partner, who had been living with me and teaching with me overseas, went back to study law at Kaplan University, and I stayed in China by myself. And I had been living on my own and, by myself in this apartment in a really abandoned part of China. I don't know if you know or your listeners know too much about the cities in China that are built, these massive places where nobody lives. That's where I lived in China when I was there. There was literally nobody. I worked at a school where everybody was bused in from outside jurisdictions and then they left. And so I lived where there was virtually nobody. It was a ghost town. And my anxiety was just getting so intense. I felt like I was having a heart attack 4 or 5 times a day. And it made me, incapacitated me to such a point where I felt I couldn't work anymore. And I remember one day thinking to myself, like, I really thought I was dying. And I said to myself, I'm not going to die in an abandoned building in China by myself. I'm just not going to do that. And so I booked a flight home and I just came home. And I realized that my anxiety, which had been a hidden piece, had really been triggered by these emotional circumstances. And so the depression had actually really morphed into an anxiety, which was probably already there, but had really been triggered and amplified because of what I was experiencing.
In terms of what men experience and how it differs in how it's viewed in contemporary society, why do you think that men still, with all the information that's available to us on the internet, on social media, and with all of the progress that we've made, why do you think men still struggle with talking about mental health? You mentioned the machismo factor and in, you know, men don't cry and stuff like that. Why is it still so pervasive, given what we know about mental health in general and what we know about masculinity now?
That's a really great question. There was a study I recently read that was actually commissioned by the Today Show, of all places, and it studied more than 1,000 men, and it found that 49% of men actually feel more depressed than they're willing to admit to even their closest family and friends. And it reveals a truth that we're just much less likely to voice our struggles. And even when it comes to thoughts of suicide, I mean, men die 3.5 times to 4 times more often than women as a result of suicide. And yet we don't talk about this, and we don't talk about it. It really is this toxic masculine narrative that men are not expected by society to show fear, to show pain, to feel guilt. Although these are all things that we feel and experience, we're taught instead to internalize those feelings and to only display and show those things that give a perception of us having the most strength. And social media certainly plays into this. where social media is a veneer of perfection. And with Instagram, there have been multiple studies that show the increases in incidences of mental illness because of Instagram. It's a perpetuation of this male machismo, hyper masculine, men can do anything but never show, the quote unquote weakest parts of ourselves. And in fact, admitting that we are struggling is in itself a tremendous show of strength. It's not weak to say you're struggling and you need help. It's not weak to say that you've experienced trauma. I mean, 6 of every 10 men have experienced one form of trauma in their life. I mean, these are just facts, and we will never get to a place. I mean, whether it's trauma-related accidents, or whether it's physical assault, whether it's combat-related illnesses like PTSD, we'll never get to a place where, as men, we're actually able to deal with these things if we first don't admit that they're happening to us. So there really becomes a point where we have to have a critical look at men's mental health and say, we are dealing with these things. They are real. They really affect us. We experience them, and they don't just affect us. They affect our family members as well. And just being honest and open. One of the other stats that I always found really telling was that men binge drink 2 times more than women do. This is and often it underlies an undercurrent of mental trauma, mental health, related issues. I mean, my own father struggled with alcoholism for much of his life, and it was until later years that he admitted that he was depressed and he struggled. So I think until we get to that point where we really stop forcing this hyper-masculine, hyper-machismo, toxic masculine narrative on our men and especially on our boys, we'll never get to a place where we can actually talk about it openly, which is kind of why I created Mental Health. And it actually stems from a movement that I started last year called This Man Cries, which was an initiative to attempt to help men talk about their struggles with mental health and just saying it's okay to cry. What I found with that, though, is that even saying This Man Cries was a struggle for men, even saying that I cry. I can't tell you the number of men who I talked to who said, I love what you're doing, but I'll never buy a shirt or I'll never wear something because I'm afraid to. Isn't that crazy? Isn't that just that they're even just wearing a shirt that says This Man Cries is potentially stigmatizing and traumatizing. So we've got a lot of work to do.
Oh, absolutely. And for my own experience, when it relates to crying, I can remember in the last 10 years, maybe 5 times I've actually really cried. Mm-hmm. And I mean, just saying that makes me realize that that's not healthy, right? that I need to feel the freedom to express myself more fully. And what you're saying is exactly right. Even something as simple as wearing a t-shirt, when we have so many messages out there on t-shirts that are far more controversial than just admitting that you cry. Even if even if you wear it ironically as a joke to say, yeah, I cry, ha, it's funny. Even that is, for a lot of men, too much to do because they say to themselves, well, if I admit that I cry, then that's saying that I'm weak. But that's not really what people should be thinking about in terms of weakness. Weakness is not being able to do something or not, not thinking that you have the strength to do something. If you have the strength to fully express yourself in every emotion that you feel, because it's all human emotions. It's not like it's a foreign thing for a man to cry. Men cry all the time. I mean, they do it in movies. They do it on TV. We see it in representation all over the world. And yet it seems to be something that we're apparently not supposed to do. And I'm like, well, it's a normal human emotion. Why would we say that that's not the right thing to do, or that it's weird, or that it's, abnormal? Because that's really what it comes down to. We think it's abnormal, but it isn't.
It's so true. And I think one of the pieces that you hit on was, and I think it's really important, are the sociocultural societal displays of that. And while we do see it in occasion on movies and TVs and films, it's not that much. It's not that frequently that we actually see these displays of emotion in our sociocultural landscape. And I think that's a part and parcel of breaking down the stigma too. And language is a huge part of that. There's so many ways that the language that we use further stigmatizes and it reinforces the need to hide when we talk about mental health challenges. And when we talk about men in particular who struggle with mental health challenges, you know, I hate words like lunatic. I mean, it's not a word that I use. Even words like insane, these are words that I actually think should be stricken from our lexicon because they are so hugely and intensely stigmatizing. And yet I even find myself that I'm so conditioned by society's male-centric machismo attitude that I use these every now and then. And I catch myself and I'm like, I can't say that. One of the other pieces I like to talk about, and I will often check in with local media, is when they talk about death by suicide. But what people still use is committed suicide. Mm-hmm. And that harkens back to a time when you talk about like committing a crime or committing a sin. It's a failure or a deficit or something that somebody has done that is wrong. And we have to eliminate those kinds of stigmatic triggers that reinforce this harmful and toxic message that mental health is something to be afraid of. It's not. We all experience it. You all have it. You know, 1 in 10 men is going to experience depression or anxiety at some point in their life. And by the time adults reach the age of 40, it's 1 in 2. So we totally are able and capable of talking about this and getting real about it. But it's going to take more and more men, especially with things like bro culture, talking about these things amongst themselves. Do you know what I mean? And I actually think what I've seen in our schools is a normalization of this conversation. And I've seen young boys talk with each other about their struggles with anxiety and fear and guilt. And so I think we're moving in the right direction. We just have to keep reinforcing the health of talking about these things, especially amongst men. Because as we've seen, when men don't properly deal with these challenges, especially when it's things like trauma, it can result oftentimes in violence against themselves and, unfortunately, violence against other people, especially violence against women or violence against intimate partners. And so we need to, talking about this, breaking it down and being real about what men experience, and that it's not something to be afraid of. It's not something that makes us weak, is a huge part of this journey.
What would you say to men that are listening to this show right now to help them if they're struggling and if they don't feel like they have the ability to speak up about it? What would you say to give them some advice?
The first thing I would say is you're not alone, and you are not alone in feeling like this. That, mental health, mental illness, mental health challenges is such an isolating thing to deal with, because you feel like you're the only person in the world that feels this way. And the horrible thing about anxiety, and especially if you put anxiety on top of depression, is depression makes you think that everything is awful. Anxiety makes you think that everybody thinks you're awful. And so when you put those two things together, it can be even more challenging. So the message I have for any men out there who are listening to this is you're not alone. There are people out there who are living with this just like you are. It's okay to ask for help. It's okay to say, I can't do this on my own, and I need somebody with knowledge, with experience, with capacity to help me get through this stage, because it is just a stage, right? Like, mental health challenges, as much as they impact us and as much as they are real, they're not permanent, and they don't have to be permanent. With support, whether it's through medication, whether it's through talk therapy, whether it's through psychological therapy, art therapy, various kinds of horticultural therapy, there's all kinds of things out there that can support men to actually make this a transitory experience so that the impact of it doesn't last for a lifetime. And so I would certainly say you're not alone. The first step is really understanding that you can and should get help, and that you deserve to be happy. It's actually a message that I shared on my Instagram yesterday, is get up every day believing that you deserve happiness. because that is going to be a huge step to understanding and realizing that you can get beyond the point that you're at right now where you could feel really low.
Ryan Painter is the man behind the Motivation Mindset Method, the fastest formula that will help you ditch overwhelm and get you the life you deserve. You can find him on Twitter at Ryan L. Painter, and his website is men2health.co. Ryan, thank you so much for being on the show today, and have yourself a pleasant afternoon.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's been a real pleasure, and thank you for giving space to talk about this issue. It's super important.
Joining me now on the line from KPAC, Michigan, we have Steven Tyler Thomas. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to start by asking you quickly about your experience with mental illness and or anxiety, and what led you to discover that you had this, that you had some problems and needed to address them.
So it's a long story. I'll try to keep it short for this. So basically back in 2018, early in the year, we lost my father-in-law, and it was kind of my first experience with, I guess anxiety. Like, I always kind of knew I had something going on, but it was not really something that I focused on. I tried to just forget about it. But in the middle of my father-in-law's funeral, I had a complete breakdown, and almost had to walk out while my wife was talking about her dad. Just got extremely sweaty, extremely shaky, dizzy, heart just racing. And that was kind of my first experience. And then I kind of continued to have small issues here and there. The weirdest thing is it was mostly while driving, that I'd get these feelings of intense, anxiety, or as I'll get to, what we found to be more so anxiety wrapped up into a panic disorder as well. And it always happened while I was driving after the funeral. That was the only time it happened at, you know, anywhere else. And so in January this year, I left work and I was on my way home, and all of a sudden it got real intense again. And, actually put me in the emergency room. I had to pull over, stopped at a store, grabbed a water bottle, thought, okay, maybe I'm dehydrated. I did drink a lot of coffee today. And I got home and, you know, I was talking to my wife the rest of the way home, and she's like, something's really not right. You know, something's not good. And the last 2 years before that, she was constantly telling me, you know, you need to go get checked out. You need to go get checked out. I don't want to see it being something more serious. 'Cause at the time, you know, prior to this year, we didn't really know what it was. And I'm not the type, I don't really go to the doctor for anything. Typical guy. And she goes, you know, I don't want to find that it's something more serious, but I kind of just blew it off. And so this happened, and I finally told her, I said, you need to take me to the emergency room immediately. I think something's really wrong. And it literally felt like I was having a heart attack. So we get there and they do all their tests and this, that, and the other. And so I guess to shorten this story a little bit more, ended up in the emergency room again 2 weeks later with an even more intense episode. And that's when I finally was like, okay, something's not right. And that's when I decided to seek help.
So then when you went to the hospital that second time, was that when you received a more official diagnosis, or did you already have some information from the first incident?
No. So actually from the first incident, they just put me on an IV, said, you are a little dehydrated. Your potassium's a little low. which potassium can come, you know, the low potassium can come with, come from too much caffeine intake. So it's kind of what we thought. I mean, I had added it all up and it was a lot of caffeine that I took in that day. And sent me on my way with a diagnosis of palpitations. And then same thing happened 2 weeks later, which at that time I had already followed up with my family doctor after the first episode. And at that point, he kind of just said, yeah, sounds like a panic attack. We're going to put you on these meds. And I'm like, okay. You know, because I'm not the type, I don't take medication for anything. I'm the type of, I'll battle a headache for 3 days before I finally break down and take, you know, a Tylenol. So he's like, yeah, sounds like panic attacks to me. I'm going to put you on this medication. Well, come to find out, the medication that they put you on, unfortunately, is usually, or put me on, I should say, usually the first step. But the downside is it can actually worsen the panic attacks. So the second time around, that I ended up in the ER, we kind of figured out, okay, maybe that's not the right medication for me. Because this one was even more intense to the point where I called 911, and got a nice little, expensive Uber ride in the wee woo wagon to the hospital. And, so at that point my general doctor kind of had decided, you know, this is definitely a panic disorder. We're going to treat you for such, but you also have tachycardia going on, which is, if you're not familiar, it's just a high resting heart rate, which can actually be extremely dangerous if it goes for too long. So they put me on a blood pressure med that's supposed to slow your heart down as well. So after that, I started going to see a therapist, and I'm still seeing her every 2 weeks. And that is where I got the official diagnosis that, yep, you do have an anxiety issue. You do have a panic disorder is what I'm diagnosing you with. We're going to work through this and you will not be on these meds, for the rest of your life. But in the meantime, you know, I ended up going to see a cardiologist, get my heart all checked out, make sure that was good. The only thing they found was, high blood pressure. So they kept me on the meds that my general doctor got, you know, put me on to slow everything down a little bit. But the official diagnosis came from my therapist.
So you mentioned a little bit ago about the notion of, you know, being a man, being told to just, you know, tough up or to man up, that sort of thing. That kind of language, I've found over the years, is really detrimental to men and boys, because it teaches us to discard our feelings in order to be more manly. But at the same time, it tends to be a detriment to our own health, and mental health is no exception. Why do you think that it took so long to finally look at how you were dealing with this and say, wait a second, something's really wrong. I need to do something about this. And it wasn't even the first time where you'd said before, you know, your wife even told you, I think something's really wrong here. It took, you know, several, you know, incidents for you to kind of say, oh yeah, something's wrong here. Why do you think we're always taught to push those things aside?
You know, I've thought about this because I've looked back and reflected on the last couple of years and, you know, what kind of led me to this point and how it got so bad all of a sudden. And honestly, I really don't know. I wasn't brought up that way. I wasn't raised that way. That, you know, men are supposed to just toughen up and deal with it. And it was just a mentality, I guess, that I developed in adulthood, because I never even really thought that way, you know, growing up at, you know, as a teenager or anything like that. So this is just, I guess, something that I've just a thought process that I've developed, you know, kind of over as I've kind of gone into adulthood. And I really couldn't tell you where it came from. I don't know if it's just maybe society, you know, because society tells us, you know, we have to be a certain way. We have to act a certain and the same goes, and I'm not going to say it's just for men. It is for women too. You know, society tells women they have to be a certain way too. But, you know, society tells men that you have to be tough, you have to be strong, you have to do this, you have to do that, or you're not a real man. You know, so I think maybe that kind of had or was a small factor in my thought process, and I never really wanted to admit that there was something wrong. But that's really the best kind of answer I have for you on that one, because I just don't know where that thought process came from.
So now that you have a name to put to the feelings that you were experiencing and the issues that were coming up for you, where do you think you go from here in terms of how you regulate your emotions and your coping skills? Obviously, therapy is going to be part of that, but how do you think that you'll be able to manage this going forward?
You know, honestly, I think just using the coping skills that I have learned so far, going to therapy, I definitely have noticed a big difference in my home life. So if I can kind of manage those things or manage, you know, those emotions going forward, using the things that I've learned, I really think it's just going to keep getting better. It's obviously, you know, a process. It doesn't happen overnight. And that's one of my big things, is I just wanted it to get better, you know, overnight. Sorry, my phone is sliding here. I'm very, very impatient person. So I just wanted it to get better now, you know, instantly. And I kind of had to realize that wasn't going to happen. So, you know, having a lot more patience is definitely key. The other thing is kind of managing stress at work. And I know probably most people say this, but, you know, I work in a pretty high stress environment. Not the place that I'm at, just the industry that I work in is just inherently stressful and by nature. And, you know, so I've kind of learned over the last really couple of months, because we had to take those, you know, 2 or 3 months off for the, you know, everything that's going on right now with the pandemic. And it kind of opened my eyes a little bit to just slow down, don't stress as much. And honestly, that's helped in a lot of different ways, from, you know, keeping things a little bit more calm at home, even to I'm actually ending up being a little bit more productive at work by not stressing as much. I just kind of let things roll off my back at this point, no matter what. And, you know, whatever happens, happens, and I'm just very calm. So I think that's a big key factor that's helping me kind of get through everything. But, you know, going forward, I credit a lot to the coping skills that I've been taught within my therapy sessions. And then, of course, you know, as much as I hate to say it, I think I can credit, you know, the medication as well, which is not something I want to be on forever. But I think moving forward, if I ever wanted to get myself off of it, you know, just continually working on those coping skills, because there's a million and one different ways that if I can feel an attack coming on, that I can kind of fight it off using those.
What advice would you have for men that are listening to this show right now in terms of how to deal with issues that are coming up for them that they don't really understand, and if they're scared to reach out for help?
My biggest piece of advice is going to be, don't be afraid to reach out for help. Like I said, that was a big thing for me, and I was afraid to know what was going to happen. Is this something physical? Is this something mental? You know, in my head, is there an emotional issue? Whatever it is, my biggest fear, I think, was that it was going to be a physical problem, that I was going to have something severely wrong with me, And obviously, you know, pushing that to the side is not going to help anything. So my biggest piece of advice is don't wait, because the thing is, a lot of, even if it doesn't end up being a, some sort of mental health issue, a lot of what I've learned is a lot of physical problems can also kind of manifest and hide themselves as mental, you know, mental illness as well. And, you know, that's, I mean, through finding the issue with the mental illness side of things, we also figured out that I had high blood pressure, which I didn't ever think I would, which I probably should expect it because it's on both sides of my family. But that if that would have never been caught, or the tachycardia for that matter, that was the big one for them, that high resting heart rate. They said if we hadn't caught it, I'd probably have had a heart attack by 35, maybe 40 if I was lucky. So, you know, don't be afraid to reach out, because there can be physical issues, but there's nothing wrong with finding out that it is just a mental illness going on. And, you know, your biggest support system, if you're married and have a family and things like that, honestly, your spouse is going to be your biggest support there. I have to credit her a lot, because I've essentially, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but I've put her through hell and back this whole year with all of this, and she's stood strong, and she understands, and she knows that if I'm on the road and I try to call her and she sends me to voicemail, if I text her and say, all I have to do is say, for real, call me. She knows that that's what's going on. She calls me instantly, because, you know, right now I'm still working on coping skills. So, you know, she is the one that can really calm me down by just talking to me. So she knows if she answers the phone and I say, hey, just talk to me, she knows that something's going on and she needs to be there. So I just keep going back to this. Don't be afraid to reach out for help, because these things can really, really become a problem. And I guess that's my long version of saying, just don't be afraid to, because there's nothing wrong with being a man and having problems like this.
Stephen Thomas, thank you so much for joining me on the show today and sharing your very personal experience with us and your perspective on mental health and anxiety.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Joining me now on the line from Dallas, Texas is Paul Kolker. Paul, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
So I understand that you have some personal anecdotes and stories of your own in relation to mental illness, anxiety, and the like. Can you tell us a little bit about how your journey began and how you discovered that you had some things to deal with?
Yeah, for sure. It really goes back to like grade school, high school. That was around the time when I actually received a formal diagnosis of just a generalized anxiety disorder. And if, you know, just as I've traced it back from what the best I can tell anyway, and from what I've gathered from various sessions, therapy sessions and whatnot, is it seems like a certain amount of it is temperamental. A certain amount of it is just, you have some, more sensitive temperaments, and I apparently fall into that category, but then also had a number of experiences of friends having to leave, move to the other side of the world at the time. I'm 35, so back then when somebody moved to China and for work, you know, like his dad had a job change, his whole family left with him, it was like, okay, I don't know what that means. I just know he's on the other side of the globe for me, and that's it. There's no Facebook. There's nothing. There's no way that you keep in touch with that best friend anymore. It's basically like a small death or a lowercase d death, if you want to put it that way. So there were a few things like that that happened as a kid. So as best as I can gather, there was just some maybe like separation anxiety type stuff that was going on, some, using adult language now, emotional connectedness type stuff. I couldn't have said those words as a kid, but it was just that sense of belonging, of connectedness, of having people and some stability around you. I had a pretty decent family life, so that wasn't necessarily the issue, but for whatever reason, various reasons, school and friendships and stuff, that was a lot more of a roller coaster than just the home life stuff was.
So how old were you then when you got a formal diagnosis that was more comprehensive rather than just generalized anxiety? And what did that mean for you to finally put like a name and a descriptor to what you were feeling?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the name is a powerful thing, that's for sure. Because for one, it lets you know you're not alone with the whole thing. It's like, oh, there's a category of people going through this. Cool. I'm not the first. I'm not the only. They know how to, yeah. I mean, not that I wish my pain on anybody else, but it's nice to know when you're in a state of pain that like, okay, there are other people who are dealing with this and they've come through it, or at least there are ways to work through it and they've figured some things out. So, yeah, I was a sophomore when I first got the generalized anxiety disorder, and then I got a diagnosis of mild OCD. I think it was my junior or senior year. It was pretty textbook. I say mild, it was fairly severe at first, but we kind of got some things under control. It wasn't paralyzing to the point that I couldn't go to school or things like that, but I would count things all the time, you know, where I was on swim team, and that was stressful in and of itself because it's just a constant workout the whole time you're doing it. I would count every stroke and more than what they wanted you to do. You know, it was like, I would have a running total in my head of the number of strokes that I had done. And I'd feel like something was going to go wrong if I didn't keep track of that. And so I was just trying to keep track of every little thing. So that OCD component kicked in a little later in high school. But knowing that I had that, and like you said, the name for it, and realizing that there are other people who have dealt with this for decades, if not centuries, or at least it's been documented for decades, you know, and we can actually read about it and figure it out. So what was the name of the book? I'm drawing a blank right now, but there was a great book somebody recommended in high school. Maybe I'll remember it before the end of this interview, but it was about how OCD is essentially like having a manual motor or manual drive car that gets stuck in a certain gear and you can't get out of it. And so it's a fault of the car. It's not necessarily a fault of your own thoughts or your will or your desires or what have you, because a lot of what happens with OCD is intrusive thoughts and feeling like you've got to do something then to overcome the intrusion, which is where the counting and things like that start to become the compulsive part of whatever the obsession is. So, the more I read about all of that, and the more I realized, okay, it's a thing. It happens to people. It's for whatever reason, for a variety of reasons, probably it's something that's just off with my brain chemistry, maybe some behavioral stuff in the past, you know, or some environmental stuff. But I mean, on the whole, it helped me to get a handle on it and just to know that I'm not just some weird, messed up kid. Like, there's just everybody has something, and a lot of people had this thing.
And when you received the initial diagnosis versus when you got the diagnosis updated later in life, how did that affect your coping skills, from one diagnosis to the next? How did you deal with it the first time? How are you dealing with things now?
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's a great way to put it. When I first got the diagnosis, I almost felt like, oh, well, there's something wrong with me. Like that was the way I heard it, which is a pretty natural thing for somebody with anxiety to do, is to internalize whatever it is they're hearing. So you hear that you have a generalized anxiety disorder. It's like, oh, I'm terrible. I'm bad. I've messed up, or what did I do wrong? And then later, as I started to learn more of this and see it unfold and hear other people's stories as well, which YouTube right now is a great thing for that. There's so many or podcasts, as the case may be. There's so many great resources where you can just hear that other people have dealt with something very similar to what you're dealing with and helps you put a name to it. When I first got the diagnosis, yeah, there was some overwhelm there. I felt like, oh shoot, we'll see proof. There is something wrong with me. I'm not a good person, or I'm not a whole person, that there was just something off or something missing. When I later got the diagnoses of OCD and kind of learning how all of that interacts, I realized, okay, I actually know what this is now. And just like somebody who deals with some other, you know, bodily condition, if you know you have diabetes, then you know how to treat it. You know how to work with, cope, and manage that particular set of circumstances. I just started treating it that way. Instead of looking at it as some sort of stigma of a mental health issue, it was, I have a health issue that happens to deal with my brain and my mind. And so let's work on that. Let's figure out the right way to work that through and kind of not judge myself so harshly, basically. And that's when I started learning more about just general health and wellness, things, not that anxiety can just be cured by any of these things, but like you said, coping skills, where yes, I did need some medication, a certain amount of medication. Thankfully it wasn't a huge dosage, but it was enough to kind of bring me back down, ratchet things down. Exercise played a big part. I realized I had to just keep up a certain amount of exercise, at least weekly. It didn't have to be every day, but I had to make sure to get in one solid workout and maybe a couple of evenings of walking, just movement, get my body moving and get my mind outside of myself, kind of thing, focused on the outside world. Eating also became a big part of that, because apparently anxiety tends to want sugar. And I'm still doing the research on this, but there's something in there where that quick hit of dopamine, I guess, that tends to come from the sugar being digested, it feels better than dealing with whatever is going on in your head, you know? So, and alcohol can actually have the opposite effect, where, or at least maybe short term, it can have a decent feeling, but like I would drop off and just crater after that. And, so yeah, I just realized it's not that I had to get rid of them entirely, but I had to pay a lot more attention to how much of each of those I was consuming.
So now that you've had the chance to reflect on how you dealt with things as a young man versus dealing with things now in your 30s, why do you think it's so difficult for men and boys to speak up about dealing with mental illness, with anxiety, with mental health in general? Why do we struggle with this, and why do we not reach out more?
Yeah. Ooh. Oh man, my mind raced off in like 40 directions on that one.
It always does.
I mean, there's a lot, I guess, you know, to the whole tough it out sort of mentality that can definitely creep in there. And I think there's a time and a place for that. Like if you're in a sporting event, obviously it serves you to try to just not deal with something that's overwhelming in the moment, because you got to finish the play, or you got to, you know, make sure that your team wins or whatever it is. I mean, there's maybe a short-term value to that sort of mentality, but I think it gets generalized into the culture a lot of times, where it's like, no, you just tough it out and we don't talk about this stuff, and that's your problem, or that's out of my depth, or go see a therapist about it. But then the go see a therapist part can sometimes sound negative or judgmental, depending on who it's coming from. And I mean, some people genuinely care and when they say that, so just want to be clear on that, but they'd probably say it in a nicer way, you know, and just that kind of approach, realizing that there were people who genuinely cared and might even actually want to listen for hour, 2 hours while you just dumped a lot of stuff out and had some, you know, verbal vomit for a little bit there. And I think realizing that there were people like that out there and that I could actually kind of get some of that out. Although I do some of that from a journaling standpoint as well, because I find that just writing something down, for one, it lets me kind of separate from it so that it's there if I want to revisit it, or it's out of my head if I don't. So that's one way that I try to do a processing or a pre-processing before I maybe go verbal vomit on some of my friends. But I'm thankful I've got, you know, a few friends like that, that we've all kind of become a closer knit group over the years. And we'll do some of the, you know, the more stereotypical things of like cigars and, you know, whiskey or whatever, but then we'll also have these very real and heartfelt conversations where I'm thankful to listen to and to know these guys, and they'll let me kind of dump out my stuff. And we're all married guys. And, you know, so we're able to kind of sympathize and talk with each other about just relationship stuff and figuring that out. And, but that also brings me, you know, to my wife. She's wonderful and lets me, discuss things with her and kind of talk things out. And she does the same with me, and we try to be healthy sounding boards for each other. And, because goodness knows there's so many things that the world can throw at you, and each person can't really handle it all on their own. So yeah, that's my experience.
What message would you have for men and boys that might be listening to this show, that are struggling with how to reach out? What would you say to them?
Well, I would certainly say that you do have to be prudent about who you reach out to, because it's not the kind of thing that for whatever reason, I mean, even some of it's cultural, some of it's just the person that you're talking to. Some people just don't know how to, they don't know how to deal with their own stuff. So they're not ready to deal with somebody else's, or they just, you know, some people's temperament are just different and they don't necessarily know how to engage with that as well. So I would just say, don't take things personally. If you do try to open up to somebody and maybe it's not well received, that could just be that person and it might have nothing to do with you. So now the flip side of that is just learning how to maybe approach some of those things. And part of it is feeling out, you know, who you're around and saying, well, this person seems like an open sort of person, or this person seems like they've been through some stuff. Maybe they wouldn't mind talking through some of mine. I mean, they've been pretty open with their stuff. So who knows? Maybe they'd listen for a little bit. I mean, there are some other good resources out there. I'm trying to think of one right now, but I mean, you can Google kind of meetups, if you want to put them that way, like in cities and stuff. I know somebody who is in essentially a 12-step program, but it's not for alcoholics. They just adapt the same methods to apply to emotional stuff. I mean, because everybody has it. Everybody has something they're working through. And so there's the group dynamic. There's an actual process to work through. And this person that I know who's doing this has had tremendous growth and recovery and just acceptance of where they are, which has allowed them to experience the growth and the recovery. So they're not running from that part of themselves anymore.
Paul Kolker, thank you so much for being on the show today and sharing your experiences with us. I wish you all the best and enjoy the rest of your evening.
Hey, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
This has been a special presentation of the Left Behind Podcast. Visit leftbehindpodcast.com for all the latest episodes and updates on socialist politics from around the world.